Session number 31558, reel 4.
And then in front, I suddenly saw a huge wadi. It was huge for the tank to go, it was too steep to go down. And on our left, about 200 yards, were these six Mark 5s, and then beyond them was the 20, and then the main Panzer Division, who were about 800 or 900 yards away. So I could see them swinging their guns round. So I said, "Driver, left, halt," and told Alf Carr, the gunner, to fire. And he started firing. I thought he'd fired 2 or 3 shots. When we met afterwards, he told me he'd fired at least 20. We were pretty short. We can't have much left in the way of ammunition. Then we'd fired the 200 or whatever we had. Anyhow, I was just about to fire the smoke and turn round when there was a terrific crash, and what happened was the 88mm came in the front and exploded in the stomach of Joe Hocking, the driver, blew off Alf Carr's right arm, filled the wireless operator Norman Mew. He had multiple wounds all over his body, liver and lungs and things, and just caught my right leg. I felt a prick in my leg. I didn't think much of it at the time, but the Tannoy, we had these loudspeakers to talk to the crew. Tannoy system had broken down. I could hear all the air pressure pipes hissing away, so I should bail out. But by that time, Alf Carr bailed out. Norman Mew got on the corporal's tank. Joe Hocking didn't bail out, and I felt jolly sure that he was dead. In fact, he was. And so I was running to Dennis Hillwood, and the next shot exploded just in front of me, and I was running very slowly because my foot was flopping about. And then as I got nearer, Dennis said, "Hurry up, John." So I hurried up as much as I could, and I caught hold of the gun and swung onto the tank, and we drove off. And Alf Carr had just one, his little finger was the only one that was left, and the whole of his arm was just bleeding like anything. So I tied a handkerchief around his arm as a tourniquet and gave him my syringe of morphia. And when we got back out of the thing, I realized that what had happened was that everybody had been told Dennis Hillwood had disobeyed orders and said, "Wheel out." I never got that because I think wireless must have been hit. That's why I went on and did this mad thing. And it was only then I was on Dennis Hillwood's tank, and it was warm, and then I was put onto another one, and the MO gave me morphine. And Tony Jarvis said, "Look at that. Look at those 5 tanks burning there, or 6 tanks." I couldn't see what it was. And I could see them burning. He said, "That's our REs have blown them up. They were the ones we knocked out." Well, I was telling this story to the regimental records person, and I suddenly got a terrific wham. I thought, "My goodness, who knocked them out?" When he said, "We did," it wasn't the squadron, because they'd wheeled out. It was my tank and my 2 corporals' tank had died. So it was well worth it, what we did. But then I thought, you know, was it worth it for Joe Hocking? I felt very sad about that, because I would never hear him singing Honeysuckle Rose again, which was his favourite song. And Alf Carr, of course, he could do nothing else, because I met him afterwards, after we got back to England. Because after that, we were taken by field ambulance to Tobruk Hospital, and I was laid in rows to be operated on. There were an awful lot of casualties in that crusader battle. The first of the cauldron, the other. And while I was, eventually I was put in a bed, and the man next door to me, who was in brigade headquarters, 3rd CLY, was also I knew quite well, and he died and was taken out. And the second afternoon, there was a man there who looked exactly like my father. and he turned out to be Brigadier, who's my father's family. The first one went into the civil service, the second one was my father, who went into medicine, the third went into the army, then there was a daughter, and the fifth one went into the church and was vicar at South Tidworth, and given lots of parties and things when we were there. Anyhow, both for the when we were there before as cadets, and afterwards when I was there as an instructor, hoping to get into the Fourth Hussars. So apparently it was he who got me put onto the train, the next train out, and he was taken prisoner at Tobruk, and he got a CBE because he blew up the petrol tank, the petrol reserves with a match, and he was captured on the roof of his building, of his headquarters. They all moved out. They said, we can't afford another siege of Tobruk, so everybody must go, and those who couldn't go were left under his command. He was anti-aircraft officer. So he got me out of that. I didn't know about it at the time at all. And then I got the train back to Cairo and 15 Scottish General Hospital. And then they took an x-ray of my leg, which was in plaster. And they couldn't see much the matter with it, really. But when they took the plaster off, it was absolutely agonizing. So much so that I kept fainting. And after that, I always had anesthetics. When we were lucky, got pentothal. Otherwise, it was chloroform or ether. I found chloroform better than to put on. Ether made me very sick. Anyhow, we got onto the. After a bit in that hospital, I was able to walk about on crutches. And I went and visited Dong, who'd did the Pat Dias. He was called Dong because the Dong with the luminous nose, because he was sunburnt in England before he went out. And then he'd been out on one of the jock columns, and which were these sort of raiding columns, and he was slightly wounded, and then he got rheumatic fever. And he was in plaster in both arms and legs. And eventually, after Montgomery had come there and things were going, we were told we were going to move right away. So we went back picked up a hospital ship, back down the Red Sea. Dong was unable to move, but I could get on deck with my crutches and see the Red Sea coast. And I thought, oh, ghastly place, I hope I never see the same again. And yet in 1960 I was down there again taking meteorological readings. I never thought I'd get back to that coast. It seemed very inhospitable. And we got to Durban, and we trained up to Baragwanath Military Hospital, officers only. It was for British Army officers and Canadian sisters and South African nurses. And there, they said, as long as you're back for a temperature we take at 6 o'clock in the morning, you can do what you like. So it didn't take us very long to get back into doing what we liked. And I had a leg iron fitted eventually. They tried a skin graft that didn't work because I had a very large wound. It was 6 inches by 10. And it formed, it took a year more to heal over the scar. And anyhow, I had a superb time in South Africa, all the parties and things, because we were the first lot there. And I even made General Smuts smile, which is, I think, the biggest record of my life, probably, because there was an official opening, and people in my ward were around the back chatting away with all the visitors, and Smuts walked around with an unofficial walkabout. So I gave him my smartest salute with crutches on. And the girl I was talking to was wearing a big straw hat, especially for the occasion. And my arm caught her hat, which was sent flying. And Smuts smiled and went on. People say that he doesn't often show any sense of humour.
What else were you doing during the day?
Well, most of the day we were resting, sleeping, and then in the evenings we went off onto parties. So we had a very good time. And then I went back to Pietermaritzburg, to convalescent camp, and from there to Cape Town, and the ship was took us round from Cape Town to from Durban to Cape Town, and it we were within sight of land all the way because the captain said that there were two submarines following us or trying to catch up with us, and he thought if it was he'd run us to shore. So we were glad to get ashore, but we put onto another boat which was far worse, called it was called the New Holland. The big one was the New Amsterdam, which was going after the war. The New Holland was very shallow built, built for the run to Batavia. It had some refugees from Iran to Mombasa before, I don't know why. And then officers were in their mess and so on. There were wives and people from the RAF who'd been flown out in Liberators in the bomb bays to Cairo and back, and they'd come back too. And the mothers went down to see how their children were and found them all screaming because they were bitten by bed bugs. And so everybody said, well, we won't go ashore in the morning when we protest against this. I think the captain heard, because in the morning he moved the boat out, away from the edge, so he couldn't go ashore. And then afterwards they gave us flit bags, and we I flitted inside my pyjamas and didn't get bitten too much. But the first night there were 14 bugs on that pillow, and so I went and slept in the lounge that was the first class mess, and I got bitten there in the armchair, so I thought I might as well be bitten in bed. And so I went back to bed and I had quite several bites in the morning. And after that, when I was orderly officer, I noticed that the wheat was full of weevils. So I held up my bread at lunch against the light and picked out the weevils. And by the evening, everybody in the restaurant was in the saloon was picking the weevils out of their bread. I'd never seen a habit catch on so quickly as that. And then Dong had gone on our boat and it was torpedoed, and he came back and went on another boat and got back, had just left Cape Town when I got there, so I didn't see him again till we were back in England. But then we went on, and the place for the ship was full of minor vermin, and then we had a tremendous storm in the Bay of Biscay, and a wave came right over the boat deck, smashed through the screen, and there's one of the officers there, David Gowries, one of the wounded, and his leg got caught in the rail, so fortunately he wasn't washed overboard, and he's broken so badly they put him on a stretcher and he stayed in the navigating officer's compartment for the rest of the journey. And when we got back to Liverpool, then we managed to get home. By that time I had a leg iron and it was okay. And I was sent to East Grinstead eventually, but they reckoned that it could do nothing in the way of a skin graft in those days. And so eventually I went to the War Office and I said, could I go to Sandhurst? And so they sent me in. Brigadier Prior Palmer was commandant, and he said, he said, what experience have you had? And so I told him, and he said, well, it's not very much, one day. So I said, well, at least it was 200 shots I fired, at least, and I knocked out several tanks. So he said, all right, you can go in the gunnery wing and you'll be here. If at the end of the month you're no good, you'll be out. So that's, since you'll never remember to ask how I do in the gunnery wing. And so I went into the gunnery wing, and I went there until the regiment came back. And that was my next time I went to the War Office, and I said, could I go back to my regiment? Or I went to the commandant, that's right. And by that time it was Bill Carr, who'd been our colonel and then brigadier. And he said, I got an idea. Because I'd been to one board and all the shots had put me grade C, and I had to be A to get back for what turned out to be D-Day, but we still talked about the invasion. And I wanted to get back to my regiment, and so he said, I'll get on to Tim Moore. Tim Moore was a PT officer. And he said, if you can do the course, the standard course, in average time, I'll give you a chit and you can go to the medical board at Aldershot and see if they put you up. So I talked to Tim Moore, and of course there's a usual catch in it. He looked in the regulations and said, you have to be carrying the equipment and the weapon, your weapon. Well, as you're an officer, your weapon's a pistol, whereas the cadets had to have a rifle with them. So that made it easier. And he said, I'll come with you. And he gave me a few training runs. And then he came with me, and I did it. And I was very frightened of heights. I've always been. The only thing I didn't volunteer for in the war was for parachute regiment, because I couldn't bear the thought of jumping out of a plane. And so he said, all right. I put down you did something else. So he crossed that out. And said, then I had to do a road run, 3 miles or something. And they went along, and after it I felt very sick. And he said, that's normal, carry on. And I did that in better than average time with my leg iron. So I got into Aldershot, and they posted me up.
What was the average time that you had to match?
I think it was, the road run was 5 miles or 3 miles. And the assault course was just doing horrible things, jumping off things that were too high to jump off. And the one I was frightened of was where you had to catch a pole and slide down. It was far too high to jump off. And actually, I said, I will do it then. And he said, oh, no, it doesn't matter if you feel like that.
You had to complete this in a specific time, did you?
Oh, yes. I did it in better than average. I did them both in better than average. So it was, I thought, really, I could be a troop leader better now than these cadets.
What was the average time that you had to better?
I think that I can't remember the time, I'm afraid. But I had 20 troops of cadets there. And so then I got graded up. I knew I was going to the regiment. So then I went, by that time, the brigadier was Bill Carr, who'd be my colonel, you see. So he suggested this Wangle. And he asked for volunteers on a tactics course at Oriel. So I volunteered, and it was very cold winter that year. And on the train, I met a friend who was in the Bays, Queen's Bays, who I knew quite well. And he walked over the grass at Oriel. I said, I'm sure you're not supposed to walk over the grass, walk round. Because I knew what the centre court of these colleges is like. You don't walk over. He walked over and said, oh, there's something here. I think it's a sunken garden. And splash, he'd walked into a static water tank covered with ice and snow. And he grabbed his bag automatically, pulled that in as well. So everything he had was soaked. And the college servants were so amused at this. And we all had to lend him something to have dinner with that night. Anyway, we were there for a week, I think. And during that week, I met my wife, Anne. And we got on terribly well. And she had started a physiotherapy department at Hatfield House. And then she moved to Oxford. And she was head of the physiotherapy at Wingfield Morris Orthopaedic Hospital under Professor Seddon. But she we didn't meet at her, well, I was being treated. I was well by that time. That she didn't even know that I'd had a wound at all. And anyway, we got on awfully well. And then I went back to Sandhurst, and before long I got posted back to the regiment, and we got married while I was at Sandhurst, and we got to the regiment, and of course I was surplus to establishment then, so I knew I was going to lose my third pip and go down to be lieutenant, but I thought it was worth it to get back, and so last time I think I couldn't remember who it was divisional general, Alan Halfer, or Brigadier, I can't remember. But anyway, he was Jack Pierce, who I was talking about in our regiment, he was ADC too, and it was Pip Roberts, not Mike Carver. But as I never came across either of them, that's why I muddled names.
Okay. Just before we carry on with the chronology, I was wondering if we could go back a little bit and if you might be able to talk a little bit about life in the desert in general and things like coping with the heat and
oh, yes,
whether you felt you were prepared.
Well, before we left England, we were issued with topies and people tied them on their tanks or lorries, but the first time we got out into the desert, the wind blew them all away, or most of them, and I never saw anybody wear one. And instead, the people they got very suntanned and brown, and even in quite hot weather, they would have their shirts off, the soldiers, because if they lost a day's pay, I think, if they were disabled by sunburn, but nobody, I suppose anybody who would have got sunburn, didn't take their shirts off. For those who got used to it, quite several of them did, and they got very brown. And the food was bad. Certainly, well, I think both during Operation Crusader and afterwards, up to Knightsbridge, we got just a tin of bully beef and sometimes a sausage or two and a packet of biscuits and a daub of Palestine fig jam. And it wasn't very tasty, but they ground up the biscuits to make a kind of flour, and we made porridge out of that. They called Burgu, and on my birthday, the B Squadron mess staff made a 21st birthday cake for me, and that was they baked this Burgu, and they melted. We had a sugar ration, a certain amount of sugar, and that was they melted some down and made icing to go on it. They melted some candles down and made 21 little candles. And so we had quite a party with all the officers of B Squadron, plus a few selected guests, which were Dick Sutton, the captain, he was called, because in a scheme in England, he was a captain, but he was in a scheme in England, he gave a map reference which put him out in the sea. So everybody called him the captain after that. And he came, and Peter McCall, who was a troop leader in the Sea Squadron at the time of Crusaders. And Dennis Hillwood was my squadron leader, as General Walker had been killed by then, and Tim Smallwood. And so Dennis Hillwood, I remember him helping me back to my tent, because one thing we had was masses of whiskey, because our RQMS, who's called Jones, his name was. He was called Punch Jones because he looked rather like Mr. Punch. And he used to go back to the Delta and fill up a three-ton lorry with cigarettes, and because we all smoked cigarettes then, not knowing it was a bad thing to do, and whiskey and gin and not beer because it got too hot. If you open the tin, it all fizzed out of the tin. But other things like that, which we could share with everybody, of course, and with all our crews, because we lived very close together with our crews, and so rank didn't count so much. We all called each other by our names and things like that, our Christian names. And General Montgomery, when he came there, it was after my time, after I was wounded, Montgomery came, but he saw Punch Jones, and he saw his Boer War medals up, his Great War medals up, and he said, "How old are you?" And Punch Jones said, 65, or whatever it was. So Montgomery said, "You go back to England on the next boat," which he had to do, so we never saw him again. But it was a long journey to England because the boat went via China. And so I don't know how many weeks and weeks it took him to get back.
How much water was available?
The ration was half a gallon a day per man. And if the vehicle needed water, you had to take it from your own water ration. So we were always thirsty. And we found the best thing to do was to have... We had to get up at first light, and we'd have breakfast of burgoo and 2 mugs of tea, and then we would drink nothing during the hot of the day, hot part of the day, because if we did, we just sweated it out almost immediately. But as soon as it got to evening and got cooler, then we had the rest of our water ration and more water, and it was quite tolerable like that. There were some people who said we'd better to get used to it and restricted themselves when we were back in the Delta. And then back in Cairo after we moved up from Sidi Bish. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to drink what I can. And of course all the research that's been carried out on those conditions and so on after the war showed that you can't get used to being without water, and it's very much better to drink as much as you can get anyway. But I think our timing of the drinking was important.
What about when it came to general hygiene then?
Well, that wasn't very good. We had to wash in petrol, because there was more petrol than water. So you could always get some petrol to wash your clothes in and wash your hands in. And as far as toilets are concerned, we just used to go for a walk with a spade. And I, being rather shy about that sort of thing, used to switch my rhythm. I used to go after it got dark, so that I could have a little privacy.
What were the sleeping arrangements in general?
Well, with the transport, when I was in Crusader, which we called the Relief of Tobruk or something, we had little bivvy tents where each person had a tent that they could sleep in. And my lorry, we could at a pinch sleep in the back, so we could leave immediately if we found we were in a sticky position. I had this Ford 1500 weight. And on the whole, it was not too bad. But one time, when two of the drivers were feeling very thirsty, they said, "Let's take a little, borrow some water from the radiator, we'll put it back when we get the tomorrow's ration." And I think the ration had been cut to 3/4 gallon for 3 days. And this was when it was. And they were all drinking their tea, and they said, "This tastes rather perfumed. What tea we had?" And then one of them remembered and said, "Oh yes, don't you remember we washed your socks in some water and we put it back in the radiator the week before last?" Oh my goodness. So that was, everything was done, I suppose, because we were all very much territorials and civilians. Everything was done with a great deal of humour, and people were very nice to each other. I don't think anybody said nasty things, and all this nonsense we see on the films about, particularly American films, about sergeants bullying their recruits and things, well, we did nothing like that. Everybody did their best, and I think, and as far as I know, nobody was ever felt bullied. Even in the training regiment, nobody nothing was held against you if you were caught out doing something, like when Ben Huff put the Evening Standard in his for a route march in his valise. He only got some extra drills for it, and the staff sergeants were laughing at it. And it certainly didn't count against him once he'd done his extra drills. It was very good spirit in the army then. I expect there is now too, actually, because now they're professionals, but they are doing the job, whereas we weren't doing our job, but we weren't professionals. So I think probably it's the best thing is to be like we always are in the British.
You didn't find the conditions in the desert affected morale then?